The National Broadcasting Company presents Fleetwood Lawton, well-known authority on European and inter-American affairs. And here is Mr. Lawton.
Good afternoon, everybody. This morning, there appear some signs that the Tunisian campaign may be entering upon a new phase, a phase more favorable to the Allies. For all accounts agree that the American and British forces emplaced along the ridge of hills overlooking Teburba and Jadeida continue to hold fast to their positions, repelling with heavy loss the desperate and repeated German attack. And Axis sources, possibly in anticipation of a resumption of the Allied advance, speak feelingly of the arrival at the Tunisian front of large Allied reinforcements, especially artillery reinforcements. The Germans are still in possession of both the towns of Teburba and Jadeida. The important railway junction of Mateur also is almost certainly in their hands. Territorially, therefore, the situation shows no great change. If any change has occurred, indeed, it is probable that that change favors the enemy. For it is reported that the Germans, by means of a strong armored counterattack, supported by intensive dive-bomber action, have succeeded in forcing the withdrawal of the Allied spearhead, which had penetrated to the coast between Tunis and Bizerte, succeeded, therefore, in reopening their overland communications between those two strongholds. This is of less real consequence, however, than the evident failure of the Nazis, in spite of all their frantic efforts, to break or drive back the Allied line running from Mateur, 25 miles south of Bizerte, to Teburba, 20 miles west of Tunis, and thence to Jadeida, which in turn lies 10 miles to the west of the Tunisian capital. That failure already is said to have been a very costly one. It probably marks a new turning point in the entire campaign. In order to reach a full appreciation of the position, it is necessary to remember that the struggle for northeastern Tunisia has passed through two distinct stages, necessary to review events which are only now becoming reasonably clear. First, after completing the occupation of French Morocco and Algeria more rapidly than had been anticipated, General Eisenhower sent a light and extremely mobile advance guard racing into Tunisia in the hope that perhaps Tunis, and even Bizerte as well, might be won by sheer speed rather than power, in the hope that those vital objectives could be gained before the Germans were ready to offer any serious resistance. This advance guard was evidently composed largely of motorized infantry and armored cars, supported by relatively small contingents of tanks and mobile artillery. Time was not even taken to provide the flying columns with air cover, and the indications suggest that the entire force did not number more than 15 or at most 20,000 men. The attempt was unquestionably worth the while. Had it succeeded, both Tunis and Bizerte by now would have been ours. The entire campaign in northeastern Tunisia concluded at very small cost. While we were engaged in occupying Algeria, however, the Germans threw powerful air forces into Tunisia from Sicily and rushed some 20 or 30,000 men, together with a considerable number of tanks, by air and sea from southern Italy and by land from Tripolitania. By the time our light forward elements had captured Teburba and Jadeida, west of Tunis, and Mateur, south of Bizerte, the enemy was ready to counterattack, and counterattack he did with heavier forces and strong air power. Then began the second stage of the campaign. Our advance guard, in its haste, had plainly lost all but the most tenuous contact with the main Allied army. It had virtually no fighter protection, since there had not been time to establish new air bases in the forward area. Striking heavily by land and air, the Germans recaptured Teburba, Jadeida, and Mateur. Confronted by heavier metal, subjected to incessant air attack, our light forces were in a potentially grave situation which only the most determined fighting could restore. Their task was to hold their ground and strive to gain time, while in their rear communications could be established, airfields created, a transportation system organized, and the main body of the Allied army ponderously moved up. Meanwhile, the continued arrival of German reinforcements added further danger, although the flow of these has been estimated at only some 1,000 men each day. But this morning's dispatches, apparently confirming the trend of yesterday's events, indicate that the Allied advance guard has surmounted the gravest problems of the second phase of the operation. It has established itself securely along fixed lines. It has sharply repulsed numerous and determined enemy assaults upon those lines. It has plainly received considerable reinforcements, especially in artillery. Now, from the nearby heights, the German armored units in Teburba and Jadeida are being subjected to a constant and rapidly swelling bombardment. This would seem to mark the opening of a third phase, perhaps of relatively brief duration. in which the Allies will turn from the defensive to the offensive once more as their strength increases, until finally the climactic assault on Tunis and Bizerte can be launched. And although the Germans still appear to enjoy a numerical advantage in fighter planes, that advantage has already been notably reduced and may soon disappear altogether. And that the enemy is most uncertain of his ability to retain aerial superiority over Tunisia is shown by a Berlin dispatch today, which asserts that huge Allied air reinforcements are flowing to North Africa from the British Isles. Ever since Friday, this account states, without interruption, the drone of a vast Allied air fleet moving southwards has been heard in Portugal. It should be remarked, however, that these must be bombers and not fighter planes, since the distance between England and French Morocco or Algeria is beyond the range of any Allied fighter. This Berlin report, therefore, should arouse especial interest in Italy, nor is the grim portent likely to be ignored there. Churchill's implied offer in his latest broadcast of a lenient peace for Italy, if the Italian nation acts without delay, the fiery demonstration of the consequences of failure to take such action, the alarming knowledge that the Allies have no intention of regarding the occupation of all North Africa as an end in itself, but only as a means of advancing towards further ventures, all these things without doubt are bringing Italy, and bringing her fast, to the point of outright rebellion. Two great obstacles, however, stand in the way. The first and most important of these is the fact that Germany will employ force if necessary to prevent the disintegration of the Axis from becoming a notorious reality. Hitler cannot afford to allow Italy to desert the Axis, since the consequences would be almost incalculable. Germany's position, both military and political, throughout southeastern and central Europe would be gravely undermined if not entirely destroyed, and the effects even upon the people of Germany itself would beyond question be enormous. The second obstacle is the absence of any suitable Italian leader. King Victor Emmanuel has been mentioned as the possible head of a new and peaceful Italian government. But his weakness and his unwavering subservience to Mussolini in the past would seem to disqualify him. Marshals Badoglio and Graziani also have been suggested, but Badoglio is reported to have been arrested, and Graziani does not appear to be sufficiently forceful. More likely, perhaps, than any of these, as the moving spirit in an anti-fascist rebellion, is Crown Prince Umberto. To be successful, however, particularly in the face of ruthless German oppression, a revolution in Italy would have to be precisely and skillfully organized, and there is as yet no sufficient indication that any real organization exists. For the moment, therefore, it appears improbable that an uprising such as to bring about the conclusion by Italy of a separate peace can be expected. There are, nonetheless, degrees of revolt. If by these appeals and by ever-increasing bombings, the Allies can bring the Italian people to such a pitch of frenzy that Italy's factories become virtually immobilized, her armed forces actively mutinous, her communications paralyzed, then Hitler will have to choose between the alternative disadvantages of devoting hundreds of thousands of his troops merely to maintaining at most a brittle calm, or withdrawing from Italy altogether. In either event, the Allies will have gained a signal benefit. This is the degree of revolt in Italy which may be immediately anticipated. The entire Allied position in Africa, and more particularly in the South Atlantic, has been further reinforced by the announcement that yesterday an agreement was reached with Pierre Boisson, Vichy's Governor-General of French West Africa, who has thrown in his lot with D'Arlon. Boisson has consented to the use by the navies and air forces of the Allies of the great French base of Dakar, and there appears the virtual certainty that in addition the United Nations will be given the use of the French naval units and merchant ships there. Credit for this new agreement is being given to Admiral D'Arlon, and it is likely that his influence with Boisson played a not unimportant part, since Boisson, like D'Arlon himself, was, until the Allied occupation of Northwest Africa, an obediently servile proponent of collaboration with Germany. It would be a mistake, however, to ascribe this latest Allied gain entirely to D'Arlon, since the situation of Dakar was, in any event, such that once American and British troops were firmly in control of Morocco and Algeria, Vichy's colonies in West Africa were virtually bound sooner or later to transfer their allegiance again. Had Boisson sought to continue enforcing Laval's policies at Dakar, an internal revolt would have been far from improbable. Essentially, therefore, the main feature of the new accord is the fact that Boisson evidently will continue to rule Dakar, but now in behalf of D'Arlon instead of in obedience to Laval. Opposition to the recognition of the D'Arlon regime, incidentally, continues to mount. General Georges Catrou, one of the foremost leaders of the fighting French and governor of Syria and the Lebanon, is the latest Frenchman to add his contribution of bitter denunciation. a denunciation which he bases upon military as well as upon political grounds. And there is a report that Ivan Maisky, Soviet ambassador to Great Britain, yesterday communicated to the British government Russia's acute distaste of the entire arrangement. Churchill is very shortly to inform the House of Commons of his government's policy in the matter of the Darlan regime in a secret session, and the very secrecy considered necessary suggests that his statement will reflect something less than enthusiasm. It is plain that concerning Darlan, the gravest misgivings are widely felt, evident that Darlan is fast becoming an issue of the first importance. That issue will loom still more large with each day that he remains in a position of any authority. Clearly, therefore, it is to be fervently hoped that this temporary military expedient will be confined to a brief period of weeks rather than of months or longer. Spain's Generalissimo Francisco Franco has made another wordy gesture of support towards Berlin, though the nature of that gesture is so ludicrous that one is almost tempted to wonder whether the Spanish leader was himself conscious of the farce. Alluding to Mussolini in a broadcast today, Franco declared him to have brought justice to the Italian people by means of the fascist revolution. He might more accurately have added that that justice has not yet been fully consummated, but that the Allies would see to it that it was administered within the not-too-distant future. And then, with both obscurity and vehemence, Franco went on to declare that the Spanish Revolution was not yet ended. On the surface, then, this latest broadcast by the Spanish dictator would seem to constitute a significant endorsement of the axis. There can be no slightest doubt that Spain is being subjected by Hitler to the most violent pressure, for only across Spanish territory can Germany bring the full weight of her military resources to bear against the Allies in North Africa. It is even most probable that demands have already been served upon Franco to that end. This is suggested by the sudden return to Madrid of the Spanish ambassador to Germany. Nor is it by any means unlikely that the flat rejection of those demands would be countered by the Germans with armed force. Clearly, then, Franco's is a most delicate situation. By proclaiming his pro-Axis sympathies, however, he may well be striving to convince Hitler that only a little patience is required to bring about the willing entry of Spain into the war as a fully belligerent accomplice of the Axis powers. If he can instill that conviction in Hitler's mind, then naturally the Nazi chieftain would be inclined to delay any drastic measures which he may be contemplating in the direction of Spain. In France and in Italy, Hitler is finding how futile it is to attempt to compel peoples by force to ally themselves in his service. To invade Spain and possibly to create there another bitter enemy, possibly even to provoke active Spanish opposition, would obviously be mere folly while there remained the slightest prospect of obtaining Spain's willing support. And if, by dangling that prospect before Hitler, Franco can gain time without definitely committing himself and his government to any specific action, then he can hope to escape the pressing danger of involvement in the war, which looms like a thundercloud filling the entire Spanish sky. This, then, would seem to be Franco's immediate purpose, although it cannot be predicted with absolute certainty that he will withstand Hitler's imperative demands and face the consequences in the event that the German warlord refuses to be hopefully patient. Spain is beyond all question in a critical predicament. But it must be remembered that the conditions which made Franco resist the insistence of his brother-in-law and then foreign minister, Ramon Serrano Suñer, when Suñer was urging Spain's entry into the war in order to share the spoils of victory at a time when an Axis victory was considered assured, have not been changed. Spain still must depend entirely upon imports from overseas for food and other essentials. Franco must know that the Allies in command of the seas would swiftly occupy the Canary Islands, Spanish colonies in the Atlantic, if he were to provoke them to active hostility. Spain's entry into the war, then, would mean internal disaster for the Spanish nation. It would mean the instant loss of all Spain's overseas possessions, the final collapse of the Spanish Empire. Perhaps it was precisely of the Spanish Empire that Franco was thinking when today he alluded to Mussolini. But now time's up. That means I must say so long.
You have heard Fleetwood Lawton, well-known authority on European and inter-American affairs. Mr. Lawton spoke to you from Hollywood. This is the National Broadcasting Company.